to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
So, hello. Is this microphone on and working? Yes. All right, so I'm just going to give you a little piece of this. Here's the book I'm writing. It only needs two or three more months' work to be readable by my editor. And as Adam said, it's a book about the ownership of art and ideas, and the argument is that they should lie largely in a cultural commons rather than be treated as private property, even though that is much what we do these days. And so at the beginning of the book, I have a discussion of what I mean by a commons. And I'm going to say a few things about that to open up. It's always a puzzle speaking to a group like this because each of us is an expert on something, but we're all beginners on other things. And I never know who's a beginner on which things. I'm going to treat you all as if you know nothing about the commons. So this is a language that comes out of medieval Europe, where land and forests and streams and so forth were treated as common properties by villagers. And there's a lot of literature about what that was, and then also trying to transport this language into modern settings, such as how do we treat the internet and protocols on the internet. I think of a commons as a kind of property. Sometimes it's set up as an opposition. People say, should we have property or should we have commons? But I think of it as a kind of property. And actually, to begin, I wanted to say a thing or two about what I mean by property. So maybe I could begin by asking you guys, could somebody here give me a short definition of property? We could get two or three on the table, but we use this term a lot. We think there's such a thing as intellectual property. What would be your thumbnail definition?
Group of people have exclusive rights to use?
Yeah, okay. So exclusive rights is one of the things that sometimes, like my car, you can't use it without my permission. I have exclusive rights to it. So in that sense, it becomes my property. Any other? Anybody want to complicate this or expand it? Or
Let's see. Anything that I have, anything that I can use and have some degree of control over.
Okay, so use and control. How would this be then be different from?
Because it wouldn't be exclusive control.
Yeah.
It would just be that,
right.
Or more accurately, I can determine the nature of my use. So, like,
right.
Sunlight is not my property, although I use it. But it could be said that the road is at least to some degree my property because I can determine the nature of my use.
Sure, so they could be common. There could be public properties that you have access to and use.
Not
and
mistaken.
Yeah, and my own, I have an old dictionary called the Century Dictionary from about 1900, and it has one definition that's always intrigued me, which is that a property is a right of action. So I could think of this cup of tea as my property at the moment because I have certain rights of action in regard to it. I can drink it, I could give it away, I could sell it, I could throw it at you. Well, that would actually not be one of my rights. So property, well, one nice thing about rights of action is that you can then exclude certain rights of action. And another way this gets described in some law literature is that, well, property is always a bundle of these rights of action. A bundle of sticks, that there's if I own a home in Cambridge, I have a lot of rights of action around it, but in fact I don't have all of them. I can't convert it into a Walmart because there's zoning and so forth. And I like the rights of action idea because it imagines behind that included in property are actors, that it's there because human beings do things. This business of exclusion, though, is often comes up as one of the definitions. And let me give you two quotations. This is William Blackstone, who was an 18th century British jurist, and he has a famous compilation of British law. And he defines rights of ownership as that sole and despotic dominion which one man claims and exercises over the external things of the world in total exclusion of the right of any other individual in the universe. This is a maximalist right to exclude a version of a property right. And in fact, this is commonly the right to exclude is taken to be the core or the main thing that we care about in property. So in fact, I found this. This is actually Justice Scalia in a Supreme Court decision says, the hallmark of a constitutionally protected property interest is the right to exclude others. Now, I actually think that the right to exclude is a subset of the rights of action. So it could be one of my rights of action is that I may exclude you from my car. But I like the more capacious definition, partly because I'm interested in cultural commons, and I'm interested, therefore, in cultural actors, in people who create works of art, or people who are political activists, or people who want to express themselves in the public sphere. So the puzzle about action is more important to me than the business about exclusion. And in fact, you can set them up as opposites, that often the right to exclude amounts to the right to suppress somebody else's actions. And this is where a lot of the tension around the commons and private property arises. Actually, I'm also interested in action because in the Middle Ages and on, the word common sometimes gets used as a verb. So this is from a law book from the 18th century. Generally, a man may common in a forest. So you have common use rights, but you could common as a verb. Okay, so this is the first thing I wanted to say about commons, is that it seems to me useful to think of a commons as a place where you have this bundle of rights of action. And then the question is, what are the rights of action? And there's a lot of work been done on this. In medieval Europe, they were mostly rights around agricultural use. As a commoner in the village, you had use rights on the local pastures. You had a thing called the right of turbary, which meant you could cut turf for heating your home. And there's a whole list of such rights. One quick thing to say that comes up often in discussion of commons, there's a famous essay, as many of you must know, by a man named Garrett Hardin called The Tragedy of the Commons. And Hardin was not a historian. He was a population biologist. And his essay is concerned with problems of population growth. But he sidetracks into thinking about the commons, and he has a fantasy about what a commons might have looked like that begins by imagining a space that's open to everybody, and if so, and you're a herdsman in a village, and the fields are open to you, your impulse will be to put as many sheep on the field as you can, because you're going to maximize your income. And so Hardin says the rational herdsman will just keep adding sheep. And the problem, of course, is that if you have a pasture, you get too many sheep, the thing collapses. That physical commons have carrying capacities. They get destroyed if too many animals graze on them, or too many fishermen take fish out of the common waters off Cape Cod. So Hardin's vision is that commons are by nature tragic. And many people have criticized this, and the point to make is that, of course, traditional commons were highly rule-governed. There were lots and lots of rules about who could do what when. So, for example, you were only allowed to cut wood in the forest between Christmas and the 2nd of February. There were limits in time and in space and in how many cattle you could put on the field and so forth. So commons were highly stinted. They had governance rules. In fact, one of them would be the rule, the right to exclude, that commons were local entities and people from elsewhere couldn't use them. Partly the point of mentioning the customary use rights that went along with commons is to say that commons were therefore not tragic, that they lasted for millennia in Europe, not tragic because they were rule governed and stinted. Okay, so do you want to say something, Ethan? You have a nice smile on your face.
I'm fascinated by this Hardin paper because
by
the Garrett Hardin paper, because it seems like the Commons movement has been fighting against this idea for sort of 40 plus years now. And I guess I'm just wondering, in your sort of role as intellectual historian, if essentially what that paper did was put up a straw man and sort of prop it up with a couple of props behind it, why has it had such power?
You know, I think because the phrase is catchy. And also because, I'm making this up, but it may go to anti-communism, that we had, this is the height of the Cold War that Hardin presents this, and it becomes a way of saying, look, common property is by nature tragic, and so it seems to be a clear vindication of private property rights and the right to exclude. Beyond that, it is a puzzle. I say the phrase is catchy because, you know, many lay people who don't know much about this, if I mention that I'm working on this, that's the first thing they know. Yeah. So there it is, and you have to say something about it. That would be off the cuff, my sense of why that got traction.
It's a useful
And what's actually of interest is to flip it over. I mean, Carol Rose, a law professor, has done nice work on the comedic commons, the comedy of the commons, which I'll say a little bit about. But to the degree that commons really work, she says they're comic in the sense of a story with a happy ending, and a well-governed commons is a comedic, has a comedic plot, not a tragic plot. But I wanted to come then to the just to say that. Most of you probably know that the term enclosure then gets used in connection with the history of the commons, because common land in Europe and elsewhere was slowly enclosed, meaning simply that it was converted from land that a whole village could use into private properties, fenced for sheep or something like this. And this happened in England in the 18th and 19th century. And there's a tremendous literature on enclosure, but that's what it means. Literally, in terms of agricultural commons in England. The thing I wanted to add that isn't usually mentioned in this line, I've been reading this stuff to try to find useful material for my own agenda. And one thing that I found that intrigues me is it isn't just the 18th and 19th centuries, but of course, there was probably forever some tension between common land and private land, people wanting to use it to their own ends and people saying, no, this belongs to the village. And people encroaching upon the commons and commoners having to beat them back in some way. So it turns out there was customary right to tear down encroachments. That is, if somebody, you know, let their hedge grow 6 inches a year into your field, and after 5 years, they've taken a foot and a half. You had the right to beat them back. So once a year in a lot of village commons in England, there was a customary ritual called beating the bounds, where the village would get together and perambulate the boundaries of the commons, carrying with them axes and mattocks and crowbars and so forth. And if they found anything that had been built or intruded upon the commons, they would knock it down. And or if somebody, you know, had put grown wheat on a field that was supposed to be for other uses, they would just let their sheep out and destroy it. And these were convivial affairs. I have one article I read which describes, in the north of England, laborers, crowds of boys, and local constable made up the annual procession, the village providing them with cakes and beers. Cakes and liquor. They walked the rounds during Ascension Week, which is to say that protecting the commons and celebrating Christ's entry into heaven were one and the same. So these are convivial annual festivals in which you assert not only your right to common, but the boundaries of the common. And it's one of the things that keeps the commons in this situation comic rather than tragic. And this also, so this is customary. It also has an echo in written law in England. There's an interesting book called the Magna Carta Manifesto by a guy named Leinbau, who goes back and reads the Magna Carta and an ancillary document that came out at the same time called the Great Charter of the Forest for the lines, the many places in which what those documents did was to preserve common rights for agricultural England. And so in the Great Charter of the Forest, this is 1225 AD, this document forbade anyone to fence arable ground if such enclosure would be to the annoyance of any neighbors. And centuries later, I mentioned Blackstone. Blackstone does this summary of British law, and he also enumerates the remedies available when a common right is incommoded or diminished, or when land is so enclosed that the commoner is precluded from enjoying the benefit to which the law is entitled. And here's another sentence from a different judgment, a particular court case in the 19th century. If the lord doth enclose any part and leave not sufficient commons, the commoners may break down the whole enclosure. So all I'm saying is, of the many things to say about the commons, the two things I wanted to get in front of us, one is to think of it as a site of action in which citizens become actors on their own right, and that they have property in the commons because they have rights of action in the commons. and again, I'm interested in this. I'm interested in the ways in which our rules around property enable or disable ourselves as public actors, being able to live our lives in this world. And then the second thing is I'm interested in this right to tear down encroachments. And I'm wondering about ways in which we can recover the tradition of resistance. Okay. So in setting up this book and to talk about enclosure in a cultural sense, my assumption is that intangible cultural properties, by which I mean songs or poems or novels or inventions or software or all these things, are actually by nature common properties. As you all probably know, economists talk about the non-rivalrous and non-excludable quality of ideas. Let me jump back to the 18th century, because as in the 18th century, you begin to get the idea that we could own works of literature, own poems, own novels. But in fact, there was a long debate at that time about whether or not this made any sense at all, because people had thought of property as land and thought of one of the key features of your right to landed property as the right to exclude. And if you have something which is by nature non-excludable, then there's no property in it. So there were many who argued that in the 18th century, said there can't even be such a thing as literary property because it doesn't have this excludability quality. I'll read you two of my favorite quotes from this. This is Henry Fielding writing in Tom Jones. The ancients, so there was a lot of debate about how to treat ancient authors and whether book publishers should have exclusive rights to them and stuff. But so Fielding says, the ancients may be considered as a rich common, where every person who hath the smallest tenement in Parnassus hath a free right to fatten his muse. The ancients are common, where you have a free right to fatten your muse. Or here's another one. This is a Scottish. What happens of interest in England in the 18th century is the British booksellers, you probably know this, in the 17th century, British booksellers operated under charters from the Queen or King. And there was a thing called the Stationers' Company. And if you were a printer, you had a charter that gave you rights to print certain books, and nobody else can print them. You had a perpetual monopoly granted by the crown. And what happens in the 18th century, as Scottish printers come along and they say, well, you know, good luck to you. We're going to print these books too. And then there were legal fights in which it was trying to, people were trying to figure out whether law at the time allowed these competing printers to operate or not. And the argument in favor of them, there are many arguments, but one was they began to produce cheaper editions. Because, of course, if you have a crown-authorized monopoly, you don't have an incentive to discount your books. So this is one of these Scottish printers, basically saying there is no property in ideas. I'm going to read this twice because there's two words that need explaining. He writes, "If a man keep his lucubrations to himself, in such case he may be said to have a property in his noddle. But if he prints and publishes these lucubrations, so soon as one buys a copy of the book, the person who buys has just the same property as the author had." So, lucubrations. To lucubrate is to study by candlelight. It's to study by artificial light. And so lucubrations are your night thoughts. These are your musings. As if you're a student staying up at night reading by your lamp, these are your lucubrations. It was a common term, actually. And noddle means your head. So the idea is the only way you could have a property in your ideas is to keep them to yourself. As soon as you tell anybody about it, they become non-excludable public things, and there's no longer property. If a man keep his lucubrations to himself, in such case he may be said to have a property in his noddle. But if he prints and publishes these lucubrations, so soon as one buys a copy of the book, the person who buys has just the same property as the author had. Okay. So the point is, they thought, and many of us still think, that by nature, these intangible cultural things are, if any kind of property, common property. And but this isn't to say that you can't counterplot nature, that you can't make these things into property through social mechanisms, which, of course, is what we've done. We've invented these methods, particularly called copyright and patent, which introduce a right to exclude and put the state behind it to enforce it. And we do this for good reasons, which I won't go into. Terry Fisher has a nice essay called Philosophies of Intellectual Property, which sort of offers the four main rationales behind introducing a right to exclude in what is naturally a common sphere. And just to go tick them off, I mean, one of them is a sort of labor theory where, hey, I made it, I own it, all right? Another is a moral rights theory or a personality theory in which my book is an extension of me. It's an expression of myself. And if you insult it, you're insulting me. So I ought to have rights to control what's going out in the world. And then there are utilitarian theories, which have less to do with me, but more to do with the group. You need to incentivize creation, because if it's actually common, who's going to make a buck on it? And so there's a commercial utilitarian version in which we give these rights so people can make money. And there's a more civic utilitarian version in which we give these rights because the group as a whole would like a fertile, inventive cultural sphere. And if people need some limited rights to do it, that's useful. So to come back then to this question of enclosure, some of you may know James Boyle in particular. He has a new book called The Public Domain. But for some years now, he's been talking about, Boyle is a law professor at Duke, he's been talking about the second enclosure. And by this, he means the enclosure of the commons of the mind. And the thesis is, this is what we're seeing in the last 15 or 20 years, is a kind of energized propertization of what we used to think of as cultural commons. And I actually think that the enclosure of this kind of commons goes back forever, really. That in a certain sense, you can find it any place you find culture, in the sense that there's always been exclusion. I mean, ancient religions used to have mysteries, which meant we have our rituals and we keep them secrets. You're not allowed to know them. So in that sense, you have an inside and an outside. Or particularly with the invention of printing, as soon as printing appears in Europe, the governments immediately want to control it and license it. And this is a form of enclosure. So the Stationers' Company in England, which was not just the crown giving exclusive rights to printers, it was a form of press control. It was a way of making sure the press behaved and didn't print seditious and blasphemous books. And I actually found a language about this that's particular. This is late 17th century. There's a certain Seymour had published an almanac, which the Stationers' Company thought they owned. And they took Seymour to court, and they won. They beat him back. And the court opinion explained that ever since the invention of printing, a certain portion, quote, hath been enclosed, never was made common. Government documents are matters of state, for example, were never left to any man's liberty to print. So this is a very early language that precisely describes an enclosure of a commons. It's of interest to me that, you know, the commons is language that's used in agriculture, but very early on, people use it as a way of talking about cultural production, and here also sensing a tension between cultural production and enclosure. And as you probably know, the first copyright law appears in 1710. This is the Statute of Anne. And what it does very simply is to give a right for a limited term and require registration for the copyright. And I think that this law was a great innovation. Because what it did on the one hand was to break up the stationers' monopolies. Here you had monopoly powers vested in certain printers in perpetuity. And by giving printers and authors limited term rights, you take the perpetuity business out of it. And you make, it was 14 years at the time, renewable once if the author was still alive. And you also had to register for it. You had to say, I want this copyright. And the second reason that this is a cultural innovation of the first order is that it actually creates the public domain. That in a certain sense, there was no public domain until you get a clear statutory limit on the term of ownership. So now after 14 or 28 years, anything that's printed becomes everybody's property. It's returned to the commons. In fact, you could almost say that the commons is the default status of created work. The Statute of Anne carves out a limited non-common period, after which it lapses back into the commons. So in a certain sense, you could talk about enclosure at all times. But of course, people like Boyle and others are not interested, are not focused so much on these early years, but on what's been going on recently. And I'm not going to go into this much because I have something else I want to say. But I mean, sort of the salient features of the second enclosure for people who talk about it are, first of all, you don't have to register anymore, so everything is immediately copyrighted. Secondly, the term is essentially perpetual. When they argued this last copyright term extension before the Supreme Court, a group of economists wrote a brief explaining their view of the economic impact of adding 20 years. So like the corporations now have a 95-year copyright. And the burden of the economist's brief, and these were conservatives and liberals, including six Nobel Prize winners, the burden of their brief was there's no statistical difference between what we've now done with copyright and having a perpetual term. It's a trivial statistical difference. So essentially, we've returned to that. Or in the patent realm, we have erased the distinction between invention and discovery, which was a long-standing way of limiting how patents were granted. So there's a long laundry list, which we could talk about more if you want. And it'll eventually be in my book, or you could look at Jamie Boyle's book to see it. But I wanted to suggest my last point before we have some discussion. As I got to writing this out myself, I began to think that there's actually a third enclosure. So Boyle talks about the enclosure of the commons of the mind. And I want to talk about the enclosure of wilderness, or the enclosure of the wilderness of the mind. So I'll explain. So first of all, we give intellectual property rights to people, partly to reward individual creators. So in one of these models, as I said, you say, well, I made this thing, I wrote my novel, and I deserve some reward. This makes sense. But it begs the question of who you are. How do you imagine the human self? Who is the I who makes the work such that it can own its own work? And part of what I'm trying to do in this book is to open up that question and to say in a way that a lot of our IP rules instantiate a certain model of the human self, and therefore make it possible for those selves to flourish and other selves not to. So at this point, I get a little philosophical or spiritual in trying to think about the self. So I'll give you a line from a Buddhist philosopher named Dogen Zenji. This is 12th century. And in one of his lectures, he says, "We study the self to forget the self. And to forget the self is to wake up to the world around you. We study the self to forget the self." So there's a whole tradition of artistic practice that begins this way, that thinks that creativity comes out of self-forgetfulness or self-abnegation. There's a wonderful letter from Elizabeth Bishop to Robert Lowell, writing about Charles Darwin. And she says what she loves about Darwin is the sense of watching him stare at this mass of material he's assembled and then forget himself and come up with something new. It's as if to get to something truly new, something that really did not exist before, you can't work out of the known. You have to somehow have a door or window open into the unknown, into the world that has not been domesticated. So we usually think of what lies outside of owned cultural things. What's the outside of intellectual property? Well, usually we think of it as the public domain. It's all this stuff like Shakespeare's works that are out there and nobody owns them, so we can all use them. But even the public domain is a kind of domesticated sphere. I mean, all these things like Shakespeare or Whitman's poems or the know-how to make transistors, these are things which we are familiar with, which we have developed and published and named and put out into the world and described so other people can make them. And here's page 10 behind page 11. So my suggestion is there's stuff out beyond that as well. There, you know, what about the world which is not yet explored? There's an old idea that human beings need to go into the wilderness or into silence or into solitude before they can emerge as true human beings. So in the period of maturation, at some point you need to get out of the known world. You need to go away from where instruction is given and become familiar with your ignorance. This I take from Henry Thoreau. Thoreau has a wonderful philosophy of ignorance. There's a line in Walden, he says, his neighbors are so busy that the laboring man has no time to be anything but a machine. How can he remember well his ignorance, which his growth requires, who has so often to use his knowledge? So Thoreau is making a claim that it's where your knowledge gives out that you might turn into something new. So you need to be in some place where you actually don't know anything before something interesting is going to happen. You have to go beyond control and the charted ground. So let me give you two sort of concrete examples of this from the IP world, and then a more philosophical one. This one I take from John Zittrain. I think it's in his new book, but he has one story about the Apple II computer. When it first comes out, much to the surprise of its makers, there's suddenly a spike in sales. And what has happened is that the first spreadsheet, VisiCalc, has been developed to run on the Apple II, something that they did not expect or predict to happen. That is to say, this the first spreadsheet was an emergent property of a thing whose purposes, you know, it had certain known purposes, but emergent property, the whole point about emergent properties is that you cannot predict them from the thing at hand. They surprise you. And so part of Zittrain's thesis is that if you want a generative internet, if you want a world in which we get more surprises like this, you got to be careful what you lock down. Or here's a second example. this was in the Times some years ago. 1980s, some cell biologists in San Diego described and patented a particular sequence of amino acids, a family of peptides. They had no idea what the purpose of these chemicals was in the human body. But this is the practice now in biotechnology, that you purifying and describing something gives you a right to own it. So they describe it and they patent it. They got no idea what it is. So a decade later, along comes some researchers elsewhere, and they think that these peptides block the growth of blood vessels in cancer tumors. And when the people who hold the patent hear that they've made this hypothesis, they sue them for $50 million for licensing fees. So that's the way it works if you have this ownership. You know, if the right to exclude precedes your sense of what the purpose of these things is, you begin to gum up the system with, you don't get exploratory science anymore. Exploratory science, by its nature, goes into the unknown and works with things whose purposes you do not know. So to enclose wilderness means, the way I'm using it, to begin to give property rights in areas that where we yet have no understanding of what's happening. And this makes no sense. There used to be a category of Roman law called res nullius, things that nobody owns, like the fish in the sea or the birds in the air, or in this case, a gene sequence whose purposes nobody knows. And the point is, these are things that could plausibly be owned, but if you want this sort of generative world, you should be cautious about too swiftly allowing people to appropriate them. You need to have what the poet Gary Snyder calls a practice of the wild, a way of entering into this unimpeded. I'm going to jump to my final story, so we'll have some time to talk, because emblematic of this territory I'm trying to describe in terms of a third enclosure is, I use the word wild or solitude or silence. To do this with silence, here's the story. I'm interested in the practice of the composer John Cage. So
So John Cage died about 10 years ago, and Cage was interested in silence as a part of all acoustical events. And there's a famous story about John Cage. He came to Harvard in 1952 because he'd heard that there was what was called an anechoic chamber here. They'd built a room where he could go inside and there would be no noise at all, completely soundproof room. And so he was interested in silence. He says, "Oh, dog, you know, finally I get to hear the sound of silence." So he goes into this room and they lock him in. And he comes out and he says, "It doesn't work. What's the matter?" They say. He says, "I could hear two different noises. I could hear a low rumbling and a high whining." And the technicians say, "Oh, well, everybody hears that. The low rumbling is the sound of your blood system, and the high whining is the sound of your nervous system." And in a certain sense, Cage had already fought this, but at that point it became clear to him that silence in Cage's practice does not mean complete absence of noise. What it means is non-intention. It means the stuff that happens that you don't mean to have happen. And he famously composed a piece in the 1950s called 4 Minutes and 33 Seconds, which was 4 Minutes and 33 Seconds of Silence, in which a pianist comes on the stage and he opens the piano and he closes it. It's broken into three parts. And during the piece, nothing happens. But what does happen, and this was Cage's point, is it's a moment, it gives you a chance to listen to ambient sound. So, for example, in this room we have an unstoppable vent of some kind over here, which we close out normally because that's not the point of our meeting. We're not listening to the vent. But if you have silence, you have to begin to listen to the things that you do not intend to listen to. Or to do this in terms of cultural narrative, silence would mean being open, not being confined to the story that you intend to tell, allowing some other stories to come in. So the representative tale about this in John Cage is, in 2002, a British music producer named Mike Batt produced a CD for a rock group called The Planets, a CD called Classical Graffiti. And The Planets had two really different styles of music on this CD. And so Mike Batt put a minute of silence in between these two different styles, just a track with nothing on it. And as a sort of joke, he credited it to Cage / Bat, a tongue-in-cheek homage to John Cage. Okay. Chapter one. Chapter two, at that point, what's called the mechanicals kicked in. Now, mechanicals, this means mechanical royalties. So in the music business, I could do a cover song of your tune, and I just have to credit you. And then there are royalty collecting societies. They see I've credited you, and they start sending you royalty checks because you're the author of the song. So the Royalty Society in England sees John Cage credited. They start sending checks to Cage's publisher. So Cage's publisher gets a check for £400 and thinks, what the heck is this? So he figures out that there's this CD out there which has a minute of silence on it. At which point the publisher went after Mike Batt for copyright infringement. You laugh, but this is true. I've been in correspondence with a man named Nicholas Riddle, who is the London office head of Peters Editions. This is intellectual property that needs protecting, Mr. Riddle explained. They literally got into a lawsuit about this. There was a kind of amused summer of banter around this in which, actually to their credit, one thing they did was to hold a playoff in which the Planets played their minute of silence and a clarinetist from Peter's edition played the 4 minutes and 33 seconds of silence, and the audience got to decide which was the better silence. And And Bat said, mine is the better silence, because I could say in 1 minute what it took him 4.5 minutes to say. And so forth. So, notwithstanding this, what actually happened, I should say one thing. In the press, this got described as a copyright infringement suit. It wasn't actually quite that. In England, they have copyright includes moral rights, which I mentioned earlier. It's the right of your reputation and integrity in regard to your work. And one of your moral rights tends to be the right to not be misattributed. So if somebody prints a poem and claims it's mine and it's not, I can say, please don't put my name on that crummy poem. Similarly, so this was Peter's edition's complaint about that this is a misattribution. And under British law, they're allowed to sue for a copyright infringement. And Mike Batt caved on this. And they settled out of court for an undisclosed sum, with Mr. Batt producing a check on the steps of the High Court in London and giving it to the John Cage Trust. Okay. At this point, I need to back off and explain one thing about John Cage's philosophy. Because Cage comes out of this tradition of to study the self is to forget the self. There's a long tradition in which we imagine that works of art express the author's personality. So that's fine. But in the tradition out of which Cage comes, his interest is in getting away from his own personality. And again, in a sort of Buddhist context, the practice is to thin out the self, not to assert the self. And Cage's interest in chance operations was a way of trying to get away from his own intentions in the work. And his interest in silence was also a way to get away from his own intentions in the work. So, in a certain sense, Cage's creations are an attempt to remove the personality from the created thing. Now, this is a puzzle because a lot of intellectual property law presumes that it's there because the work contains the personality of the author. This is certainly true in Europe. European law assumes that the work contains the imprint of the author's personality. It's less true here, but in fact, there's a famous Supreme Court case, 1903, over the question of whether such a mundane thing as a circus poster could be copyrighted. And the Supreme Court says, yes, this is Oliver Wendell Holmes. An artist draws from life, makes a work that is the personal reaction of an individual upon nature. Personality always contains something unique. It expresses its singularity even in handwriting, and so forth. That is to say, the Supreme Court also buys into this idea that one of the reasons we give the property right is because the personality subsists somehow in the work. So that's fine. But if you're an artist like Cage, or if you're trying to work in this way where the leading edge of your creative practice is into the unknown and out of the charted self, then perhaps the law should have no standing in regard to this kind of artistic practice. Or if the law does have standing here, if even the fruits of self-forgetfulness end up on the high court with checks being exchanged, then my line is that surely the third enclosure is upon us, the enclosure of silence, which I mean both literally and figuratively, the enclosure of this sort of unknown portion of our of the human self and of the world we inhabit. And to close, let me come back to... So what I've done is to say something about the commons and made a couple of points about it, to talk about the commonness of created work by nature, and then the carve-out that we allow for certain reasons, And then Boyle and others, myself included, the idea of a kind of new enclosure of the commons of the mind, and then also this third thing, which is an enclosure of the commons that lies even outside of the chartered territories. And to link the back end of the talk to the front end, the question would be, if this is the way we now operate, if biotechnology firms can stake claims on unknown portions of the human genome, or if the law allows Peter's Editions to sue for somebody using silence, how do you become a creative actor in that world? How do you become, what are your rights of action in a world that's constrained in that way? And also, how would you resist? How would you beat the bounds of this common or tear down encroachments? So that's a little ramble through some of what I've been working on.
Question of resistance.
Yeah.
One thing that struck me was when you were talking about how the commoners did it in ancient Europe, they would offer free beer.
Yes.
and you know, one of the interesting things about, you know, little phrase running around in the open source community is like free as in free beer versus free as in freedom. And I'm wondering if part of the problem with defending the commons is if you try to sell it as we're defending freedom, you're not going to get as much success as if you sell it as we're defending free beer. And there's, you know, there's a lot of things there, right? Like free beer suggests, one, that...
I should interject just to say, I mean, I think in the open source community, Stallman's phrase is free here means as in free speech, not free beer. So he distinguishes free beer as not being... included.
Right, but I think he has it backwards.
I see.
I think that, like, fighting for free beer is a much more compelling thing to fight for than free speech. And I don't mean that entirely, like, flippantly. Like, one is, you know, if you're just, you know, if you're a villager that's beating the bounds, and someone says, no, we can't do that anymore because of private property, you're going to go, where did I get my free beer? So you're going to fight for this right? Because it causes an actual loss of utility.
Yeah.
The loss of free speech doesn't really create the same immediate loss of utility as the loss of, say, like, free beer.
To just add, to work with you on this, I mean, it also goes to conviviality. I mean, I think that these sound like they were fun events. So, yes, I think you need something that people care about because they are the things you long to do before you're going to have people defending them.
Right. I mean, and it's also the sense of, I think, community, right? Like, the other thing that beer is commonly used with, the term is used, is he's someone I would like to have a beer with, right? So maybe part of the problem of commons is that they're so spread out that if the people using the commons are not people you know, that is, not people you want to have a beer with, the incentive to fight for these things is a lot lower.
I'm going to suggest this to my publisher with every copy of this book.
It's an opportunity to have a free beer with you.
I'm just thinking of a free beer without me, but...
Among the four, Terry's four philosophies of property, the moral rights, I think it's within the moral rights one, is a notion of basic fairness. And you alluded to that in passing, that I wrote it, I should get the rewards for it. I wrote the novel, I should get the rewards, and put sort of the inverse is, if I wrote it and you publish it, and you get all the rewards and you don't give any to me, then that actually does feel pretty unfair to many of us. And in watching people argue about the copyright stuff, it seems to me, you know, just anecdotal, that it's the fairness argument that is the most compelling one. It's the one that Congress people cite when they're increasing the number. It it feels perpetual. The fairness doesn't go away in 70 years or 95 years or 70 years. It's fairness. It's fairness. How do you? I just want to make it clear. I think it's a flawed argument. Nevertheless, do you have any ideas about how that fairness argument has emerged in the U.S. in the past generation? How that happened and what we can do to try to unroll it as sort of the basic notion of copyright. It's all about fairness. Somebody else is not profiting from your labor, creativity.
Yeah, in Terry's typology, actually, I think it's in the first one, the fairness comes, is sort of just reward for labor. And it's a little less moral rights. But and yes, it the thing is, it's so easy to grasp and so intuitively felt that if I did it, I should have my reward, that it's become, and I guess I myself am perplexed about this because I have a way of answering it, but in fact, it takes some time to do. And this is always a problem in political debate where one side has the 6-second formulation and the other side has the 26-second formulation. I mean, what I do, among other things, is to question the I, and that's, you know, I made it, therefore I deserve. And I think there's a lot of puzzlement, many questions to be raised about what are the sources of creativity, to what degree is my contribution, you know, famously, this first, the labor theory comes out of John Locke. Locke says you mix your labor with something, you get to own it. Robert Nozick, the philosopher, jokingly says, well, if I mix my tomato juice with the ocean, do I get to own the ocean? And the point is, with cultural material in particular, you are working in a vast pre-existing sea of available material, and the fact that you're able to carve out something that is unique and has your imprint on it doesn't mean that it's entirely yours. It arises in the social situation, and it has social utility. And even if it becomes popular and useful, it's other people who made it so. So this problematizes the proprietary individualism of that claim. And I suppose the other way to do it is to talk about those utilitarian sides, in which you say, well, look, there's also the public interest here. And again, the public interest is a little harder to explain sometimes. But in fact, there it is. And originally, both patent and copyright were understood as having public good ends for which short-term private ends were allowed. So that's another. Beyond that, it's a long discussion. So.
The danger of it is, I mean, I really liked your, I liked everything you said, but your formulation of public domain feeling like it's the default, where things start, they get taken, they get enclosed, and then get released back into what is their essential home and their starting point. And the problem with the fairness of the argument is that it gives people the opposite sense of things. Really are yours, and then after 14 years or 70 years after you're dead or whatever the term is, then it gets transformed into this new public thing because it's lost some of its utility to you, the creator.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I it's one of the dangers of that.
Fascinating talk. I see you basically making a creativity defense. Generative, creative, and I want to push you a little bit on that in the sense that if we take Cage or Thoreau at heart and say true creativity lies in transcending the self, in entering the unknown, then could that be an argument for total ownership of all creative property in the sense that it kind of... an abnegation of the self. If all property is owned by someone, then you're truly forced to be creative, to generate something new.
Well, this is a puzzle of to what degree you can actually go to the wilderness. So, I mean, my own picture of this is, even with Thoreau, you get to sometimes face onto the wilderness or face silence, but there's no way to escape the world you've come out of as well. That's why I said it's like a window or a door opening onto something. So Thoreau has the Iliad with him in Walden, and Cage has, you know, the history of music.
Look at it, but it belongs to someone else. They have to create something of their own.
But what you're saying is total ownership would also mean total, that you cannot use parts of...
In your own creative enterprise, correct.
Yeah.
You could refer to it in your trying to learn about the self.
But would you need to get permission?
Well, you couldn't use it in your own creative enterprise. You could reflect upon it. But say you couldn't quote somebody else's work. That seemed like the epitome of creativity in this model.
Well, then I would have to change my model because because I don't think that's true. I mean, I think, again, I think the project here is to have some exposure to the unknown, but there's no way to escape the known. And if I think it would be the death of creativity. I mean, I think you always are working with materials you've collected from elsewhere, and yet the true creative leap begins to add one new thing or two new things, and if these materials you've collected from elsewhere, I mean, somebody points out, for example, on the second page of Walden, Thoreau begins to fantasize about the pond as if it were a lake in the mountains in Switzerland or something. He's reading European travel literature. You know, the whole book is made of other people's stuff, and yet there's something new in it because he also went into solitude. But there's no way to look at the book as not being a mixture of these things. And often what makes it... Or take the example, Zittrin's example of VisiCalc appearing. I mean, I suppose in your model, they would have to go back to Apple and say, we need permission to, this is apparently what's happening now with iPhone applications, you need permission. So under this scenario, some things are not appearing, which would appear if you didn't need to go back and ask permission. I mean, my model would always be mixed, that there's... you can't not work out of the known, but you need this window or door onto the unknown. And the worry is the custom we now have of allowing people more and more to put stakes into the unknown.
Yeah, if you tried to write a poem without referencing anything ever done before, you'd have to include the just discovery of poem formatting. And without quoting someone else's poem formatting, you couldn't do anything. And you could accidentally quote someone's formatting and they'd come and get you.
Or how about the alphabet?
So, at the risk of impugning ideas that are as Berkman as the internet and apple pie, what's so bad about private property? Right. So we find ourselves, you're hearkening back to an extremely romantic conception of the world. And a romantic conception that worked very well for a small number of people in a specific...
A romantic conception of common property?
A romantic conception of common property, a romantic conception of wilderness. I mean, it's a thoroughly romantic analysis.
Yeah. Well,
we've got. I'm setting up a straw man here. You can knock down all the pieces of it as we go there. We've got an enormous amount of scientific, commercial, other forms of development based on increasingly strong enclosure movements. These increasingly strong enclosure movements have given us a great deal of what we like, love, perhaps, of the world that we interact with. And they seem to be counterbalanced against these fairly romantic notions about our inability to create. The truth is, despite the first enclosure, the second enclosure, it doesn't appear that human creativity has been all that challenged. Yes, we've got filmmakers who grouse about the fact that they can't use the can of Coke without getting all the clearances of it, and it's clearly more of a pain in the ass than it used to be. On the other side, we have enormous thriving creative industries of people doing work in these spaces. Again, another strawman that you can knock down on this. So why should we be worried about this third enclosure, an enclosure which seems to be as big or as small as an enclosure, literally of a right to silence? Isn't there a response to this which essentially says that you're attempting to protect and defend something that most of us have not really experienced? You're sort of hearkening back to much, much older ideas, because in many ways they actually have very little to do with either the physical or intellectual environment that we've encountered. How do we know that this extremely romantic vision is in fact somehow superior to the world that we're interacting with?
Well, first of all, I mean, my own position is not against private property. I believe in a mixture of these. And the problem for me always has been, where do you draw the line? What are the appropriate boundaries of the right to exclude, and where should we stop having a right to exclude and have something else? And the sort of gross assumption here is we've extended the right to exclude too far, and we need, and therefore there are problems. The puzzle about, you know, it's a wonderfully creative world, all this stuff is constantly popping up, what are we missing? The puzzle is we don't know what we're missing. That partly this attempt of mine to describe a third enclosure, the enclosure of the wilderness of the mind, is to say, here we foreclose commons which we do not even know because we never get to see them. And again, I guess my concrete examples go back to the kind of stuff that Zichern was doing and saying, here were surprises that appeared in the internet community which nobody could have predicted. They are emergent qualities of a system which did not have the kind of dominant control that other systems might have. And these surprises turned out to be useful things. If we had had a different level of control, we never would have had those surprises, and we never would have missed them. I mean, it's a paradoxical claim that there could be a kind of creativity which we will not even miss because we never even get to see it.
But Zittrain is actually talking about a very, very small distinction, right? I mean, the distinction that Zittrain is talking about in many ways is the distinction between the mini computer and the personal computer, right? So in the mini computer, you were generally buying the software and the hardware.
Yeah.
Now you've got hardware out there, not open hardware, by the way, you know, highly proprietary, not an open operating system, still highly proprietary, but the ability to be generative on top of it.
Well, my second example, though, was this business of property claims in biotechnology,
mm-hmm.
Which, again, the idea would be, to the degree that we take the human genome and other biological products and begin to make them property regimes before we know what their purposes and uses are, we gum up exploratory science, and certain things will not happen, and we don't even know what they are because they never happen. And I somewhat get this out of Sulston's book on the human genome called The Common Thread. And this is his line about the way the Human Genome Project worked, that the people in research institutions now are highly reluctant to do certain kinds of work out of, you know, if you come in with a $15 million licensing suit, you don't feel free to operate in this space. So again, you know, this is a biological space in which there's unknown territory. Let's leave it open so that people feel free to explore it. I don't even think that one's romantic. I mean, I agree that, you know, going back to Thoreau, there's a touch of the romance, but
I want to let other people ask questions, but my pushback on this would be, when you're hailing back to Thoreau, when you're hailing back to 17th and 18th century England, isn't there a possible pushback which essentially says, we know some of the gains we've gotten out of a private property system? Here's my biological pushback to you. I'm a type 1 insulin-dependent diabetic.
Right.
4 times a day, I take human recombinant DNA insulin, which exists primarily because Eli Lilly did an enormous amount of research, created a monetizable product that they kindly produce at a price that I'm able to afford thanks to the vagaries of the U.S. healthcare system. Now, I'm willing to trade off a lot of possible creativity for not having to deal with 18th century medical science. To what extent do we believe or know that the innovation and the progress that we've made over the last 300 years is somehow connected or disconnected from the progress of science and useful arts as protected by copyright, trademark, etc., etc.? Aren't you sort of holding out this, I'm going to use the word again, extremely romantic hope for creativity that comes off from this unfenced wilderness in exchange for a regime and a system which, despite obvious flaws and a couple of wonderful absurdities, which you point out here, has yielded an enormous amount of progress in useful arts?
Well, why don't we leave that hanging? I think it's a good question, and I think the one thing I would say maybe is that because in a sense what you're defending is what is in fact the in-place dominant system, and I think you're right that it produces some remarkable things. Partly the task of a book like mine is to pester the dominant system, mm-hmm. even though and in a certain sense maybe to overstate the case at certain points. But I take your point.
I'm only giving you a hard time because your system ends up being the dominant system within this room. So I'm simply pestering in a similar fashion. But I'll shut up now.
Yeah. We got a hard stop at 1:45, so we got 2 minutes.
So this, I think it's going to have to be the last question.
So I guess I'll end on something like that. There's actually a guy who's been writing a lot about this, and I think about what Ethan originally asked, which was why the tragedy of the commons is so dominant. Michael Heller, in his book, The Gridlock Economy, and talking about the lost economic profits that you get from these sort of things, right? Perhaps a lost investment because it's too costly to worry about the patents, that sort of stuff. And he goes through all these economic models to try to say we should reawaken some of this economic commons in these very esoteric economic fields. And I was wondering if